Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello everybody, welcome to Pilot Episodes, and as always I am joined with our three pilots, but before I introduce them, please remember you can go and find us on Twitter at I think Pilot Episode Pod, and one of these days we'll get some other social media channels up and running. So who shall we start with? Why don't we start with the guy who is not going to be future Chief of the Air Staff, because I'm not allowed to say that.
Well, Goddard, you just said how... he's not going to be Chief of the Air Staff.
Yeah. We can't call him.
I can confirm I won't be Chief of the Air Staff.
Unless they all die. I was actually watching the film today. Designated Survivor? And I was actually thinking of you, Goddard.
That's not the one with it. What, everyone?
Yeah, everyone dies.
JB, the fact is that if you say the person that's definitely not going to be Chief of the Air Staff, actually, that's probably me.
that's actually all four of us.
Yeah. Oh, well, something that we've all got in common. Goddard, what have you been up to since we last met up in Farnborough?
So, we haven't been actually together for a while, have we? I've fleetingly seen various people. But in aviation terms, I met up with Parky at the funeral of Geoffrey Wellham, which was quite an emotional event, actually.
Maybe we can talk
more about that a bit later. And I actually visited a mutual friend of ours, Smithy, over at Biggin Hill in the Heritage Hangar the other week. And just he invited me over to go and have a look round. He was doing passenger trips in a 2-seat Spitfire, which is clearly Parky's day job. And I just had a look round this amazing hangar. Both the boys have seen it, but just some fantastic aeroplanes in there, including this ME-109E, an original.
Wow.
That was probably airborne at the same time as P-7, which was also in the shed, the P-7-350, the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight Spitfire, which was in there being refurbished. Both of these aeroplanes in the same shed that could have been airborne at the same time in the same battle during the Battle of Britain. So had a brilliant time over there and watched a bit of the air show as well. So actually, for a bloke who flies a desk on a daily basis, a little bit of aviation recently.
Now, I'm not going to let you just get away with that before I introduce the other two, because you have done some flying. Didn't you sneak onto the Royal Flight or something?
Oh, yeah. So that was on the way back from Geoffrey Wellham's funeral, where I did have a train ticket, but there happened to be a BA-146 going back to Northolt. So I asked the pilot nicely, and he let me sneak on.
Well,
I must admit, I'd forgotten about that and had amazing views of London after we'd landed at Coningsby and then flew back at about, I think it was about 10,000 feet back to London. And the feed-in meant that we were 10,000 feet over Northolt, and then descended out over towards the east, over the centre of London, and then back round over the top of Wembley, in on an ILS on the Westerly runway. So that was a lovely view.
That's excellent, at the end isn't it?
That day,
that really is who you know sort of stuff there.
Oh, it was definitely. I just went, any chance of a lift back? And he went, yeah, of course.
There you go. Simple, isn't it?
Just pop on board.
How about?
No problem with that.
So my second. my secondary way of getting back was actually flying with Bucky, who was flying his wife back from Culdrose as well.
Is that
right? I
thought
that was a little bit more dangerous.
It was the most random collection of aircraft, a BAE 146 on a four-engine jet airliner, a Spitfire, a four-seater Robin with me and my wife in it, and then Disco in his father-in-law's Cessna. And we all got airborne about the same time. It was pretty weird.
Well, it was definitely magnificent men in their flying machines.
Well, that voice that you could that you could previously hear there is the pilot that time forgot, but we certainly didn't. And we missed you, Parky. We missed you in Farnborough.
Yeah, I'd like to say I heard the podcast, but obviously I couldn't be bothered. But
oh, nice.
Really good.
That's really touching.
JB, that is just such a fantastic, you know, that it's not something I've heard Parky referred to before, but it's absolutely hit the nail on the head. The pilot that time forgot. You have summed Parky up absolutely magnificently. We can just end the podcast now and I'll be happy.
There we also go. Knowing Parky, I know he's listened to every second of both of those.
Of course, he has. Look, the amount of direct messages.
My children's lives, I haven't.
The amount of, look.
If he's not involved, then we're dead to him.
Look, the amount of direct texts that he sends personally praising my interview skills, I know for a fact that he listens to both of them. So I'm absolutely fine with that.
Yeah.
So, Parky, what have you been doing? What have you been flying? Have you done 70-odd trips in a Spitfire? Come on.
Besides, I did my logbook today, and in 3 weeks, I did 87 trips, which I think is a record.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's been pretty busy, but as God
is that not illegal, Parky?
No, you've got to have one day off in the previous eight. All good. But it's sort of
really?
Six trips a day is our norm, so they don't half add up.
Sorry, when you say a trip, are you flying someone?
Some of them have been in the single-seater information, but yeah, the majority have been, yeah, flying boys in the two-seater out of Heckel.
Now, what's your favourite...
Someone in the back seat making sure that he's doing it properly.
Now, yeah. They're there to smash him around the back of the head to wake him up.
Now, no, it's been awesome.
As almost kind of a semi-tour guide, I guess, of a Spitfire, do you have anything in particular that you like to tell your guests that are flying?
You know, just it's brilliant. You know, you just let the... you're introducing the to the best aircraft ever. It's an easy sell. And I still know my way to Dover and back.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that your line, Parky? Is that...
Hey, works.
As the Spitfire tour guide that time forgot. come on.
Really. Spitfire
What's
tour
this?
Guide. what is the crescendo of your trip, Parky? Come on.
The crescendo of my trip?
Yeah. Do you give them a roll? Is it a loop?
I don't think we should go there.
The best bit... Yeah, there we go. The best bit's down by this thing. Although, having said that, if you get a few decent puffy clouds just to play with on the way home, that tends to float everyone's boat. That's brilliant.
How hard are you allowed to fly the Spire?
How hard?
As in, like, do you do any aerobatics? Or is it just there and back?
Yeah. But if they're up for it, do a victory roll in the overhead, do a loop if they want.
Wow.
Are you
VFR only, Parko?
Absolutely.
Right, so I guess you'll be sort of keeping the requisite amount of distance away from those clouds.
And when you say
playing with, I guess you mean
clouds.
you're offset by the requisite,
500 feet, Dunk, obviously. Yeah. Okay. In sight of the surface at all times. Yeah.
I was just going to say, do you remember that time, Parky, where we were doing a little bit of playing around on the way back from a sortie and ended up getting into a dogfight?
Dog fights.
Oh my God.
It's all right,
God.
Mason. You weren't the boss. Oh, Jesus, maybe you were the boss.
It was more heavy petting.
dog wrestling. Dog wrestle.
You see, but JB, genuinely though, as God has said, the main event since we all last did one was dear old Jeffrey's Wellham's funeral. It was unbelievable. Maybe we'll ditch on about it, but it was an unforgettable, you know, moment in my life.
Yeah, well, actually, I think that is an excellent idea, and we will talk about that. But before we do, I'm going to introduce our last pilot, a man that's only seen a Mach number higher than one on his razor. It's Dunk.
That's only seen what?
I like that. How long did you take, you think, to come up with that one?
Look, I'm Comedy Gold. I can do this all day long.
Comedy Gold. Alan Partridge.
I think that would be my call sign.
I'm going to have to listen back to that because I didn't really hear what you said.
Well, you'll have to wait for it to go up on iTunes.
The thrust of it, Dunk, is you've never been supersonic.
Well, that is true. That is true. Happy, mind you.
Dunk, tell me about what you've been up to then. Have you been instructing instructors?
And what have I been doing? I'm at Linton on Ouse at the moment, so okay. I'm not in my normal place. I've had a great day today. I've been off instructing around the Lake District at low level. But sort of in the past few weeks, I've been over at Valley doing instruction there. We got weather recalled whilst I was in the Hawk, and it was on a Friday. I was supposed to be going home in a Tucano, but thunderstorm and lightning came, and it meant that I got stuck at Valley. So I've had a few sort of aviation trials and tribulations, which has kept me busy. And then I was on holiday as well, which sadly meant that I missed a funeral. And I think that there's a bit of karma about, because I thought, right, I shall go out. I'm going to have a bike ride and then I'll come and have a beer for Jeffrey. And on that bike ride, I fell right off and smash myself up like a good one. And all I could think of is, I bet Jeffrey's had a little chuckle to himself as I bounced down the road.
Now, is that the little fall you had the other day and you posted it on WhatsApp?
Was it on WhatsApp? I did put some pictures on something or other, yeah, but I took
it. Yeah, that wasn't a little fall, Dunk. I mean, that looked like your entire leg was a scab.
Oh, yeah, I've only got one leg now.
It did look like it smarted a bit.
Yeah, it did sting a bit. Although the worst bit was the the French guy in the car behind. We're digressing a bit, aren't we? But he's sort of wide-eyed, so it must have looked fairly spectacular. I bounced down the road. I ended up in a ditch, and just to add insult to injury, there was a thorn bush at the bottom of the ditch, and the way I bounced, I just landed right on my arse with thorns right up.
Oh, right, Jeff did do well on that one.
Oh, yeah, Jeff definitely pushed him off in the right place.
He having a little chuckle to himself in the big crew room in the sky, wasn't he? Well, he said, what are you going to do now? I said, well, I'm just going to carry on. He said, no, you can't do that. You've got to go and get it seen to. So, yeah, he was right. The worst bit about it was getting it. Spraying the disinfectant on.
Oh,
that stings.
I assume it is a very well attended event and one of the last veterans.
Yeah, I mean, you know, definitely the few get fewer, but he was just such a mate of all of us, really, just the most wonderful, wonderful bloke. And I mean, the night before, we had to sort of fly out, as we mentioned, after the funeral, just various reasons. So the night before, we all got together and met up in the pub where Jeff used to go boozing, and just had a mini session. His family all came over, and it was just this impromptu booze up, which was just brilliant. There was a picture of sort of on the wall and where he used to sit. And it was kind of like he was with us, and I just know he would have so approved of it. So, you know,
when you say mini sesh, Parky, someone told me you couldn't walk.
It was slightly. I had to, had the honour of carrying the coffin, and I know he would approve because I had a stinking hangover, and then I had to do a bit of a eulogy at the church, and my tongue was sort of stuck to the roof of my mouth, and it was difficult. But I just sense he would have gone, well done, boys. That was a good effort, and there was a great fly past at the end of it. You know, when we lowered Jeffrey into the ground, you know, the last post was played, the Padre did his little speech, and then Andy Priest came over in the Mark 9 Spitfire to the second. You know, the timing got us was just brilliant, wasn't it?
Unbelievable.
So, and you know, it was just the most fantastic send off, and I know we would have approved. So yeah, that was it, really.
So
hangover at all.
Just tell me this then, Parky. I mean, why is it that you and Jeff were so close? I didn't actually realise that.
You know, you sort of get on. I don't know what it's strange, isn't it? But, you know, met him probably 11, 12 years ago. And then we constantly, you bump into people at shows and at all the do's. And, yeah, I would just annoy him with my presence. And it was just brilliant. It just is, his sense of humour, the charm, it was just, he was just a wonderful mate. And, you know, we'll all miss him. But what a life. And say, I think we get a good send off.
Yeah, and JB, you know, Parky's doing himself a bit of disservice there in terms of, you know, managed to, where he said he managed to get through a bit of a eulogy. I'm never normally complimentary about Parky, but he made me blub. You know, I'm not an overly emotional person, but there was three times during that day where I definitely, you know, almost had to take a... One was Parky talking. There were three eulogies, one family one, one from the... Battle of Britain Veterans Association, and one from Parky. And Parky, you'd been on 92 as well, hadn't you?
Originally,
same as Jeff. Yeah, so Parky gave a very personal pilot perspective on Jeffrey, which hit all right notes, you know, mainly probably because he was hungover, you know, and looked a bit teary himself.
That's
but in this tiny little church in this little village in Cornwall, and the church itself was packed with just local people really and family, as some of the Royal Air Force. We were lucky enough to be in there, but you walked outside the church and it was lined all the way around with, you know, residents of the local area, other military personnel who were just going to turn up on the day, and then. There were two aspects in the actual burial. You know, that Spitfire flypast, definitely something caught in the back of my throat when that spit came over, just as Jeff had reached the last part of his travels there. And then the final bit was just, I went up and saluted as we were all walking away. And his little, I guess, great-granddaughter, came running over to the grave and said, "Bye-bye, Grandpa Jeff," and then walked off. And I was stood with Disco at the time. We both got up and saluted, and we both had to take a knee at that point. But then it was a really good chat and you know, chat in the pub afterwards, and really good to catch up with so many people. So it was, I don't know what you thought, Parky, but, you know, emotional, but a huge privilege to be there. You know, what a wonderful life. I've reread First Light over the last couple of weeks, you know, on the way down there and then subsequently afterwards. And I hadn't read it for a few years. You know, we talked about it, but I'd forgotten what an amazingly well-written and poignant book that is, that took me right back, you know, all the way back to flying training as well. So just flipping brilliant.
Yeah. I'm going to just change the tone a bit here, because I wanted to mention First Light. And just think... Parky mentioned earlier on that they all went for a good drink prior to the funeral. One of the things which really struck me throughout that whole book was, A, the consumption of tea. Everything had to be sweet and wet. I mean, I absolutely loved that. But also the amount of drinking that they all did. I mean, there's one thing to give a eulogy with a hangover. It's another thing to fight the Germans.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, Jeff was he had his 19th birthday in the battle, so
yeah, he did,
was so young, and that's how he earns his nickname, you know, Boy Wellham, because Brian Kingham said, "Don't get tight again, boy," because tight was getting a bit of ming-monged in the pub, and you know, they had to sort of, I guess they were just completely unwinding at the end of the day. You know, boys were getting killed, and it was just a way of letting their hair down. But it must have, yeah, added a little bit to the fatigue after. After you've been in the pub and then you're woken, you know, at 4 a.m. to get back on, you know, it's like First Light, to be back on, ready to scramble again.
It's amazing, isn't it?
And that they did, you know, week after week.
Yeah, that's the one thing which I felt was so staggering, because, I mean, you couldn't imagine anything even remotely close to that situation now. Whether it be, you know, the actual, you know, the combat situation they find themselves in, or, you know, the fact that it's okay to go to the pub at night and then get up in the morning and fly a Spitfire.
Yeah, I think 92 were renowned for being quite a bad lot, as it were. I mean, they got the most kills. They were a very, very successful squadron. But
is that right?
I think discipline was was a minor issue. One of the new bosses that came in, the first thing he did was to stop them flying in their pajamas.
No.
Brilliant.
That can't be right.
You mentioned that, but...
They used to just put their number ones over their pajamas because, you know, literally straight out of bed and then, you know, down to the Spitfires for alert. And it was like, it doesn't look right, boys. Stop that.
No, I mean, one of our friends, Tony Cooper, who flew Spitfires on D-Day, said he did his first mission on D-Day in a Spitfire. And there's a photo in his logbook, you know, apparently the only photo... not many people were taking cameras flying, but the only photo out of a Spitfire on that day. And he was wearing his pajamas then. He said, you know, so early in the morning, it was cold. Do you remember? We talked to him about that. I think I know.
It was, but what happened with that is that Tony... So that wasn't the only time. There's a fantastic story about a dawn patrol that he did over to Belgium. On the way back... they were shot up, you know, when they were doing the sweep that they were doing. He went back above cloud. And he said, and then my engine just completely seized, just the propeller stopped dead. So he was above cloud and he thought, he doesn't really know where he is, but he thought, right, I think I'm over the channel. And I think the closest land actually is back towards Belgium. So he turned back towards Belgium and he came out of cloud at about 2000 feet. Which isn't particularly high when you haven't got an engine in a Spitfire. It's about, I don't know, 20 seconds, 25 seconds before you're down on the ground. So he came out of cloud, and to his surprise, he was over land. And not only that, he was over an airfield. So he sort of set himself up on finals before realizing that the airfield had been trapped. So big poles had been put in the ground. So he had to, on short finals, roll left, land in this field, and he got out of his Spitfire. And he set fire to it, because that's what you're doing. And as he was setting fire to it, a half track pitched up and he turned round and it was an English captain. And the English captain said, "You're bloody lucky." And he said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, 24 hours ago, these were German lines." He said, "Hop in, I'll give you a lift." So Tony finished burning the spit, got in this half track, and the guy took him back to the local manor house.
Chateau, wasn't it?
The chateau, yeah. And the lady of the house was there. Her husband was off fighting. But he said as he was introduced to her, he realised he was in his pyjamas. She then very kindly gave him some clothes to wear. And just in an amazing final part to this story, you'd think, well, how'd he get back from Belgium? Well, the next day, a DC-3 Dakota came and landed on a field clip nearby. He climbed into it and got flown back to the UK and was back on the squad and back on ops 2 days later.
Good lad. That's awesome.
Now, amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, here's what I want to know, right? Godders, you've been a stage, right? You were a stage at Lossiemouth, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. What did they fly out of there? Tornadoes?
Well, when I was there, it was we had one squadron of tornadoes and three squadrons of typhoons in flying terms. There was all sorts of other things flying out of there all of the time.
Yeah. Okay, so I know this isn't in no way analogous, but what would you think if one of the tornado pilots clambered out of his machine in pyjamas?
Well, we had this conversation about cowboy boots recently, didn't we? I'd be surprised. I'd invite him for a chat, definitely. You know, the funny thing is, I guess the way most people would think is that I wouldn't necessarily think, you know, what the bloody hell, he's wearing a set of pyjamas. I'd be wondering what the backstory behind it was.
Well, he was hungover.
Well, presumably he would be, which would be the issue. There's a mutual friend of ours that I won't mention his name, but he's got a fantastic story. So every year each RAF station will have a summer ball, which normally, you know, just like any, I was about to say any ball you normally go to, I don't know how many people go to balls. I've just happened to have been to one every year of my life that I've been in the Air Force. But, you know, they get dodgems along, bouncy castles, you know, that sort of stuff. But you're in all your finery. And they go on a while, and there's always a sort of breakfast for the survivors the next morning. And this friend of ours, he was on quick reaction alert the next day. So he went straight from the ball to quick reaction alert. And as they were running in, they got a shout. So he quickly got dressed up. The way they handed it over, he rushed out to the airplane, got airborne. I'm not going to even tell you the airplane type either, because clearly this person will be identifiable. And as it happened, so they went up, I think it was against Russian Bears. The Bears turned around or did something else, so they didn't get to intercept them. But when they came back, the station commander was there when they landed. And as this individual unzipped his immersion suit, it was obvious to everyone he was still wearing his number five with bow tie and medals and everything in the, underneath, and wasn't actually wearing the fireproof flame retardant gear that you're supposed to.
So that will get you into trouble, am I correct?
Yes, he ended up on someone's carpet for that.
Wow. Right, okay then. Well, let me move this on, because you know, listeners might not think it, but we do somewhat plan these, kind of, right? Ish?
Yeah.
Ish.
These are like well-oiled machines. We've been on script the whole time so far.
Exactly. So I was doing what I do, because I'm a little bit of a nerd, and I was reading Wikipedia, and I was reading about...
Must finish that by now.
Oh, I completed... No, it's about reading the updates now, more or less. I was reading about the Sea Vixen, because I thought, that looks like a nice aircraft, twin boom, nice and pointy, so on and so forth. And then I was reading, right, it was basically a fleet interceptor, except for two small problems. It had no lockdown shoot-down radar, so it'd have to be literally or near enough at the same level as what it was trying to intercept. And also, it couldn't shoot anything which is oncoming, and it had really short range. So it'd have to get up, get behind something, and then get down basically to sea level in order to shoot whatever it was after. And this struck me as a terrible, terrible idea. And I'm just wondering, throughout all of your aviation experiences, have you come across anything equally as badly thought out as that?
I guess, Dunk, you and I'll wait for Parky to talk on this one.
Exactly, yeah.
So what are you going to talk
all
about?
The aeroplanes I've flown have been brilliant.
Well, you don't have to flow in them, I just need to know about them.
What was the radar like in the Harrier, Dunk?
It was excellent. I tell you what, you could shoot up, down, left, right, whatever you wanted.
Didn't they forget to put one in it?
It was full 360, Parky.
It was.
Hey.
Absolutely no problems with that.
Wasn't it the Javelin that was Britain's first all-weather interceptor, and the radar didn't work in the rain?
Is that right?
That's what I heard.
Well, Porky, did you ever fly with Blue Circle radar?
The one that got the bad press was the Tornado F3, but by the time I got to it in 91, they just... It was the Fox Hunter, and they had done this mod called the Z-List. So I'm clutching at straws now. But essentially, the track was scanned, and it was beginning to work pretty well by then. It was definitely better, the F4 radar that I came from, the Phantom one.
Wasn't it, the F4?
Yeah, when it first came in, the F3 radar was pretty pants. But, it's like a lot of the way the RAF, you know, they get equipment. But by the time they, you know, it came out of service, it was brilliant, you know, with data link, and it was very good. But, you know, I'm
kind of not how you'd want it to work, though, is it? Do you know what I mean? You've hit the nail on the head. You're absolutely right, Parky. But you're right. We kind of get aeroplanes that are a little bit crap. And then just as they're going out of service, that actually the Harrier was a prime example of this. It was, you know, it was a fantastic platform for close air support, particularly over in Afghanistan, and the upgrades it had were great. It put it in a really, really good position. It was just a fantastic platform, and we retired it. So, but when it came in, it could hardly do any. It hardly had any of that capability.
Well, going back to Blue Circle,
an aeroplane that's great when it arrives.
But genuinely, F-35 is that. That thing has got a massive amount of capability straight off the bat. And is only going to get better. So I think with doing it the right way around this time. But JB, did you mentioned Blue Circle. Do you know where that story came from?
Isn't it because the concrete brand is Blue Circle?
Yeah, because the early ones in the F2, as they got into as they entered into service, didn't have serviceable radar. So they used to have to put ballast in the front rather than the radar, you know, just to make the weight and balance work. So I'm sure it wasn't a builder's bag of Blue Circle cement, but that's where it got the name, the Blue Circle radar.
I do love that idea, though.
And Parky may have even flown. You didn't fly the F2, did you, Parky?
No. It was, that was sort of, I think that was late 80s, wasn't it? Maybe 87, something like that. But
as a kid, I was always really excited about the F2, the F3. It was the auto wing sweep thing that got me, where, you know, people had said, the books I'd read said you had to manually sweep the wings in a GR, but an F3 had auto wing sweep, which sounded like the coolest thing on the planet when I was, a teenager.
We weren't allowed to use it, though.
Really? Why not?
I don't know. It was definitely, it was not allowed in the release of service. The Saudis used it. They used the auto wing sweep, but RAF, no idea why we had to manually do it.
What, you never thought to ask?
No, it was just... what I remember was that if you... It was kind
never
of...
Never really gave it much thought.
The switch was definitely there, but it was kind of a bit slow. So in other words, there were various speeds that you had to observe. But if you were fighting it as a fighter and you hit a merge, and as you slow down, you basically wang the wings forward and put your thumb on the manoeuvre flap and slats. That should have been automatic as well, if it wasn't. But essentially, if you put it in the auto, it was just slower. So, you know, it would... And then clearly, if you had the wings back and you're pulling and you've gone a bit slow, it would bleed speed even worse than it did bleed speed, which was a lot. So it just wasn't as efficient as if you manually did it. That's what I was told.
Ah, so you never actually used it, even though it was in the airplane, and you never used it?
Always, and, you know, the F3 display, you always just... You know, your left hand was just constantly messing around with the wings and the flap and slat, because, again, in every other jet, something like that, as soon as you pull a few units, you want these, you know, the wing to produce a bit more lift. So, but it was just manual in the F3. So yeah, you were just constantly messing around with those two levers.
Wow. Wow.
So, yeah. So Parky, on that on the display, was it quite busy then? Because, I didn't fly the Typhoon display, but I've flown, that sort of profile in the sim. And obviously with the Typhoon, you don't have to do anything. You just pull the stick back and it does its stuff. Put the throttle where you want to. Were you maneuver flaps and slats and wings and all of that all of the time?
Yeah, so maneuver flap and slats. So the thing that I can remember was, I just did one pass where I popped the wings back. There was no, I didn't do anything in sort of 45 wing or any of that. So it was either fully forward or fully back on the wings.
Photo wing.
But if you did any inverted-y stuff and you inadvertently kept the flap and slat out, that was bad, because bizarrely, it was quite good. You know, completely clean the wing, flying upside down, it was all right. But you wouldn't want the flap and slat deployed upside down. So I once did it. I remember at 500 foot, I forgot, and it was fine. But I just had to push way more than I had to. You know, that was the norm to fly upside down. So yeah, you definitely would. You know, maneuvers in and out constantly. Yeah,
excellent, boys. You must have heard of some other bad aviation ideas.
Well, wasn't there, was it the vampire that we saw at Farnborough?
Yes, we did see the vampire.
It came into land. I think it was either the vampire or the venom. That didn't it have some sort of death dive if you had the flaps and the air brake out at the same time?
Oh, I don't know. Is it?
Or the Meteor, was it? Yeah, you're right. There's one of the early jets, because there was a crash about that, wasn't there?
I think, a lot of the early jets did have their foibles, didn't they? You know, the even the Harrier,
if you got the big barn door flaps that you used for slow flying, slow takeoff, slow landing, that sort of thing. If they sensed in the early days, if they sensed there was an imbalance between the two flaps, that they were either withdrawing or extending at a different rate, because that would then cause a rate of roll, they then automatically froze. But then if you were putting the nozzles, if you had the nozzles down and you were putting them back, and when the jet wash then impinged on those flaps that had now stuck, it produced an uncontrollable pitch down. And we had a friend that I think he was the first to survive it, actually. I think it had happened a number of times. When you took off in the Harrier, you would, for a short takeoff, these flaps would be deployed. You'd trundle down the runway at whatever speed, about 60 or 70 knots. You would, at full power, pull the nozzles down to about 50 or 55 degrees. The aircraft would leap jet-borne, and then you would translate into airborne flight by slowly rotating the nozzles backwards again. And as they rotated, as they impinged on these flaps, if the flaps had stuck, you got this uncontrollable pitch down. And, of course, you're just off the runway at this point, so you're only a matter of feet. And a number of American aircraft had had this, and the pilot had died. He hadn't got out in time, or if he had got out, he'd been then crashed into, because, of course, he's then ejected along the runway with the aircraft as a fireball coming along behind.
Now, isn't this... wasn't this because the US Marines were using very inexperienced pilots to start with?
No, it's not really to do with that.
Was it not?
There's not much. We train for it in the simulator because once it became a known problem. However, we had a friend who was on the squadron, on 3 Squadron, and it happened to him. And he was the first to survive. He ejected as the aircraft was nose down in the vertical. And he describes it as he thought, oh, my God, I'm going to die. So if you can imagine, as the aircraft is pointing with its nose pretty much on the runway, so he's looking down the runway as he ejects, and he saw the canopy above him shatter, and he thought, that's me hitting the ground, I'm going to die. But then realized then as he went out on his seat that, oh, he survived. And then as he went out on his seat and the parachute pulled him out of his seat, he then hit the ground, and that hurt. And as he was looking backwards then, he could see the jet then, this fireball coming towards him, and he thought, oh, that's it, I'm going to die. But luckily, he just went left, the jet just went right, and it went scooting down one side of him. And he ended up, with broken legs and, you know, badly injured but alive, there on the runway with the jet having passed him, and ended up in a fireball, you know, down the runway.
I remember I remember him saying it was like the last scene in Die Hard 2. You remember when he lights the fuel and the aeroplane crashes? He said it was like the last scene in Die Hard 2 coming at him down the runway.
Yeah, I mean, flipping.
With two broken ankles.
Yeah. Oh, goodness me.
So, I mean, he was so... I think, you know, as design flaws go, that's pretty bad.
You know, JB, all aircraft will have their, you know, quirks, stroke issues, and, you know, Eric Winkle Brown must have flown some absolute dobs in his car, you know, where he went, they just never got, you know, did a bit of test flying on them and went, no, these are just shocking aircraft. You know, we've tended to obviously fly the ones that made it and were deemed successful and good. I was chatting to JR just yesterday down at Duxford, and he's flown the Lysander. Put about 6 hours on it, you know. There's a Warden, but the new Lysander, it's going to Goodwood apparently. He's going to fly it in there, so it looks beautiful. And you know, I was sort of, you know, what was it like? And he'd flown a Lysander about 20 years before, but they're great aircraft. You know, they were sort of used for the special ops, and you know, very just, you know, taking boys SOE operatives into sort of France at night. But he said this thing is kind of all pretty much auto slat, and the flaps does some, you know, automatic stuff. So it comes down automatically, and then it's crucial that you trim it and keep trimming it. So on the approach, but if you overshoot, it's an absolute nightmare. If you put the power on too quickly, it will just pitch up into an uncontrollable pitch up, a bit like the Harrier done, Well, that was nose down, but this is nose up.
Yeah.
And he came out with some story that some mate, essentially, for whatever reason, hanging around in his Lysander. And it was just good pitch up. But he bizarrely managed to get it into a turn. And it just ended up doing this back turn round and round at about sort of 3 foot until eventually he managed to sort of trim it down and get it all squared away and sorted. But it was the most impressive thing everybody said. He's definitely dead. But he managed to survive this one. But, you know, and that was a great aircraft that was, you know, used throughout the war. But, you know, just an example of just, a very critical bit that you had to handle it right at a certain stage.
Yeah,
I was watching a YouTube video just the other day. There's a I think it's a, you know, it's a company, Superstol, that it looks a bit like, you know, the Cubs that they fly with the enlarged wheels out in Alaska. Have you ever seen that where they land on the beaches?
Oh, I saw this today. It's amazing.
Yeah, so I saw a version of this, and they, you know, they've got these massive, almost tractor tires that are underinflated, if you like, which is part of the cushioning as well. These big undercarriage that are a bit like the Stork that we flew at a Warden. And the video as well shows the automatic flaps and slats, which is purely air pressure that brings these things out. You know, I think the Messerschmitt had, you know, auto slats at the front. You know, which came out when it needed it, but exactly the same sort of technology. And funny enough, I did think about trimming and then putting power on and getting into, you know, running out of stick control in it, because that must be it must still be a thing today.
Sorry, Godders, are you talking about the video where the plane throws itself off a cliff?
No, I do know that one.
I was watching that today with the massive tyres. It literally just throws itself off a cliff.
Have it had enough of life?
It drives over the top down
the podcast.
Yeah, that was it. End of.
Dunk was coming out to assess it.
It's one of those Stoll, you know, I think that's a Super Cub, that particular one, Dunk, and he just rolls off the side of this hill in Alaska somewhere. And, you know, by virtue of the fact he's now pointing downhill with more than 40 knots on, just flies away from it.
Nice. Well, you know, and I guess, you know, we'll probably come out with maybe a long list, but we used to speak about, we love to see a Mosquito on the Battle of Britain Memorial flight, or, you know, even just flying in the UK would be brilliant.
Yeah.
But I don't know exactly what the facts and figures are, but there's certainly a period with that aeroplane. So we discussed that if you lose an engine on takeoff, you don't have enough rudder authority to compensate for the adverse yaw that's created, and she'll just spin and crash, and that's it, you're done. And it's just a known sort of, right, from that speed to that speed, that you can't do anything about it.
Mm. Well,
Starfighter, JB.
Yeah, I was about to mention the Starfighter, the F-104. 25% mortality rate.
See, I wonder if they got extra pay for being Starfighter pilots.
Oh, there is not enough money to make me get into a Starfighter.
The thing is, though, JB, that's the difference. So there is a bit of, you know, we spoke about the young being fearless.
Yeah.
And the fact is that when you're looking at that rocket and going, well, I can fly this, you're not thinking, 25% die. You're thinking,
I'm in the 75%.
Epic. I'm getting in it now.
It's amazing. So because obviously it had its very small wings, its turning circle apparently was horrendous. So what they used to say is, I'm banking with the intention to turn.
Where did you read that?
Oh, God. Who knows? Go with Wikipedia. I have no idea.
Who would they say it to?
I've got no idea. I don't know.
The black box, the cockpit voice recorder, in case they didn't come back.
No idea. And I'll tell you another one which I found out the other day, which I think is very, very strange, is the MiG-21. Apparently they had different speeds depending on which fuel tanks are used. So you've got a belly fuel tank and you've got wing fuel tanks. But the wing fuel tanks can dispense fuel quicker than the belly fuel tank. So as soon as you went onto the belly fuel tank, you effectively limited your speed.
Yeah, okay.
I think there's so many aeroplanes with just little things like that, JB. You know, I mean, even the Hurricanes, the way they're modified on BBMF, the tanks and the way you feed the fuel on the tanks with the little switch. I was always worried about that the first time first few times I disappeared away from Coningsby, and you had to switch over to one tank, and there's no fuel gauge. You're waiting for a light to come on, and I can't remember which way around it now, but the light would flash, wouldn't it, and then go steady, and then the engine would cut out. So that was the time to turn it onto the other tank. I never actually took it to engine cutout. But
there's no fuel gauge on a Hurricane,
not for the overloads.
Those were overload tanks.
What does that mean then?
There were three tanks were gauged, but where the ammo used to be put, they put 12 and a half gallons dunk a wing.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, and that would give you about, each one would give you sort of, 18 minutes of flying. But as Goddard says, they just weren't gauged. So you had to do it when you as a low workload part of the sortie. So some sort of, between Coventry and somewhere or other, you go, I'll use my overloads then. And you put this funny little switch on.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
On and check that the engine kept going, and then hit stopwatch. And 18 minutes later, you'd just be looking for the flashing light to start appearing. And you could check the bulbs on them, couldn't you? So you'd constantly be pressing those to check a bulb had gone.
I'd forgotten about that. Yeah. About 10 minutes in, you're just constantly pressing bulbs just to make sure it happens.
Yeah. Good fun.
So, well, I mean, I think it was, a couple of episodes we even spoke about, like, the Jaguar couldn't pitch. What could it not do?
We were saying that it couldn't fly. Couldn't roll and pull at the same time.
That's the one.
Roll and then pull.
Yeah, yeah. I really like these little idiosyncrasies which seems to be built into aircraft, because I just can't imagine for the life of me why they didn't test it before they put it into service.
No, I think they did test them. It's just by the time you got to that sort of,
which is even worse if they did test it.
Yeah, they would have tested and found out these sorts of things. But there's so much stuff that you can only do a certain amount of testing, especially during the wartime. And so you might not actually find that part of the envelope that could be a bit spicy. They always talk about that the F-16 had, I think it was a single generator when it first came into service. And they soon realized after a spate of generator failures that they needed another one. They had another generator in there. There was some weird thing that used to happen that both of them failed. So they ended up putting this hydrazine generator in, which was a sort of get you home. You know, this hydrazine battery would fire and it powered the flying controls for, I think it was about 10 minutes, Parky, 10 to 15 minutes, depending on how nervously you were wanging around the stick and the flying controls. But that allowed you to dead stick an F-16 into, you know, if you could find an airfield nearby, you were never going to land one of those in a field. But there's, I was about to say hundreds, but there are tens of occasions when someone has saved an F-16 over the years by dead sticking it into onto a runway.
Now, hasn't the F-16 got another safety feature? I think this is it might not be new now, but it was new to the F-16, which is if you were to pass out, it automatically levels out.
No, that's a new thing. The sort of auto ground collision type technology. It wasn't ever if you're going to pass out. Typhoon has got an auto recovery button on there, so you know you're in cloud, you're upside down, the things aren't looking right. You can press the auto recovery button, and suddenly you're back the right way up again.
God has got one of those as well, because he often faints like Basil Fawlty.
No, I used it in the Typhoon the whole time, mate.
Oh, I thought it was for pilots. I thought I'm sure the F-16 one was. I assumed it was for pilots passing out, but obviously I'm completely wrong there.
Hey, no, before you end, I'd just like to say, Godders, that what a lovely descriptor you used there. Things getting a little bit spicy. I like it.
I was going to say suddenly the cat's standing upside down on the canopy.
And you play.
I might be upside down.
Yeah, and then like your playing cards and your spare change is there, and devastating stuff.
Hey, now just to go back to what we were talking about initially, we were talking about the two seat spits down at the historic flight down at Biggin Hill, the Heritage Hangar. Yeah, and there were some lovely photos that Smithy sent through yesterday. I just thought it was worth mentioning. When we were talking about Jeff, God rest his soul, I thought it was worth, we were talking about the few, and Smithy sent through this fantastic set of photos of him taking 99-year-old Archie MacInnes, who is a Battle of Britain pilot, flying in the two-seat Spitfire. And there's just the most wonderful picture of Archie with the biggest grin on his face, just absolute wonder. And you know, I think everyone that has seen the pictures will agree he looked younger than Smithy by some margin, because it had just taken him back to when he was a boy. It's just
certainly, you know, had a smaller nose.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but I mean, it was just great to see the you know, those Parky. You know, have you? I guess, you know, given, as you were saying, you've flown, I guess, hundreds of punters now in your tour guide role.
Yeah, well, you know, the other day, Dunko, there was a French mate. I sort of met him the day before, and he was saying he was flying. And he was a translator, but, you know, I sounded like hello, hello, sort of speaking to him. But essentially, his dad was the last French Spitfire pilot, and he passed away about 3 years ago, called Andre Rose, and it was Alan Rose who I flew with. But he brought his logbook in, and it was the same thing. It was just utterly brilliant seeing the mates, RAF. He was 329 squadron, which is a French squadron, and did 99 offensive ops and about 15 defensive escorting, you know, Lanks and stuff. But he did all the way from sort of, you know, pre-D-Day. He flew twice on D-Day and then all the sort of landing strips right up through to sort of ended in Holland in February 1945, and then went back to end of the war. He was in Scotland, bizarrely. But, you know, he spat, I think, four locomotives and loads of trucks. No airborne kills, but just that bit of history. It was just wonderful. Just never heard of this guy, but really fascinating, you know, seeing it and speaking to his son about his dad and everything. But those are the bits which are really special and completely out of the blue.
Yeah, very cool.
Did I tell you that I can't remember I've said on the pod the story of when myself and Prov took the two Harriers into Cannes and we met this.
As in Cannes, as in the French Film Festival, Cannes.
Yeah, that one.
You took two Harriers to Cannes.
Yes.
Awesome. No, please.
Not the Croisette. There is an airport next to it.
they took them down there for the film festival. That's how we roll.
Strangely enough, I'm just looking through the media.
It wasn't a waste of taxpayers' money.
I'm just looking through the media on the Pilot Episodes Pod WhatsApp group, right? And I'm literally on the picture now of Godders in a film premiere with a Spitfire. So it wouldn't surprise me that much. And he was on the Royal Flight back home.
On the Spitfire, that had been landed very roughly in the street behind. But this, and apologies if I've told it before, but this old French guy comes. So when was this? This was about 96, 97. And this old French fella comes up when we'd landed and he goes, "Hello, I'm French. I was in the Air Force."
Oh, yes.
And spoke exactly like that, almost in received pronunciation. We went, "Really?" Anyway, went and had a drink with this guy. And he had fought in and around the Battle of Britain. I think it was after the battle. And he had the most amazing stories. But the one that always sticks with me was he was on flying at the Biggin wing. And they'd all been invited to London on a stand down day because one of the, I don't know whether it was Supermarine, I don't know whether it was Vickers, had put, someone's going to tell me they're exactly the same company now. But the there was the 1,000th kill or Hawker, possibly. So it must have been a couple of years into the war, 1,000th, 100th, 500th, whatever it happened to be. And they'd had this. Here we go. This is full circle because it goes back to what you were talking about at the beginning, JB. But he said he got absolutely bat-faced, woke up under a bed somewhere in London at about 6 o'clock in the morning and thought, bloody hell, I'm briefing in an hour and a half. He mentioned there was a couple of girls in there with him. You know, he'd obviously had an amazing night. Got back to Biggin Hill. And as he walked around the corner holding his parachute, there was a couple of guys. So this must have been a bit later on because they'd just been in a briefing. So it must have been, where did this guy live, Parky? I don't know whether this could have been the same guy. So they were going over to, they were going across to France. And he said, "What are we doing?" He said, "Well, here's the radio frequency, you know, just keep up." So he ends up, he's absolutely hungover like a dog, has had no briefing as to what they're doing. So he just takes off in formation. Had written down the radio frequency or had screwed up his radio somehow, so didn't get to speak to anyone. And at some point over northern France, everyone just disappears. They all break away. So he just ends up flying squares in the sky, you know, not flying level for more than 10 seconds in the combat area, just looking around the place, can't see anything. So fuel goes down, ends up coming back, landing back at Biggin Hill. He said he was sweating like anything. His head was absolutely killing him when he got out. Said to one of his mates, "What happened?" He went, "Oh, that was amazing, wasn't it?" He said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, that's the most Messerschmitts we've seen since the battle. You know, what an amazing fight. Did you see what was going on, this and that? And, you know, we lost Johnny," and he hadn't seen any of this. And it was exactly the point you were making earlier, that he's hungover in the middle of France, having had a belting night out. But he did say, had he got shot down on that day, he would have gone down happy.
Well, I've got
it's astounding, isn't it?
What was he doing under the bed?
I don't know. That stuck.
A couple of girls.
We've all been there, mate. We've all been there.
Don't go there, Dad.
Come on,
maybe he was chivalrous and
hiding from them,
given up his bed space. But that part of the story always stuck with me. It'd be amazing to if that was the same guy, Parky, if he only died a couple of years ago, that you flew his son. But yeah, flipping amazing.
He had a good log book, put it that way. It was very cool.
Hey, as we're talking about veterans, I had a miserable day on Monday. It was a day chained to the desk. Miserable. But the one ray, the chink of sunlight that came in was that Lynn, who does our admin for us, she came and she said, "Oh, I've got a 96-year-old gentleman on the phone who is a Lancaster radio operator. Would you speak to him?" And so I answered the phone, and it turned out
This chap was a guy called squadron leader Abraham Garrett. And he was, as you said, a Lancaster radio operator. And he was calling because he's going to do a Battle of Britain, although he wasn't in the Battle of Britain. As a veteran, he's going to go to a Battle of Britain dinner and do a speech down at Halton. And he was trying to find out, because he said it took him 7 months to go through training. He was trying to find out how long it took to go through training now. But of course, things digressed and we just started chatting about all sorts of things, about the fact he flew Tiger Moths at Saskatchewan over in Canada on the frozen wasteland. And he said he was telling me they had Tiger Moths with enclosed canopies. But they found out they had to take those off eventually because they were getting carbon monoxide poisoning. So they ended up, you know, in minus 20 or whatever it was, flying open cockpit Tiger Moths over in Saskatchewan. And then he flew Yorks. And he flew. He did the Berlin airlift. So we were ditting on for some time. And sadly, someone came to the door. Told me anyway, he's probably.
I used the same excuse. To you, like, so
I've used that one too, Parky.
So, but it was fantastic. Just things like that that come out of the blue, and you get to chat to these guys. He was talking about signing on at Lord's and what they, you know, all sorts of stories, as you were saying, Goddard. It was a privilege to talk to him.
Hey, talking about two-seat Spitfires as well, did any of you guys watch Flying Across Britain with Arthur Williams on Channel 4?
No, you mentioned that last time. Didn't see that.
No, I didn't either. I wish I had.
It's still on catch-up. Everyone out there needs to go and watch it. It's such an amazing guy. So, Arthur Williams, he was an ex-Royal Marine. I think it was who broke his back in a car crash. So he's paralyzed from the waist down, is in a wheelchair. But after he left the Royal Marines, got his pilot's license, and he's got this absolutely beautiful cub that's modified for him, obviously, because he can't use the rudders, and in a tail dragger like that, you're going to need to use the rudders a lot. So he's got this amazing stick down the left hand side, you know, that sort of sticks up, and it looks like it's got a little handbrake device on the side, I guess, so that he can keep rudder in and be able to take his hand off of that and use the throttle as well. But I had a Twitter conversation with him about it, because I just thought the programs are really, really well done. The first one, he flies into Compton Abbas, and I guess you guys may have done flypast down there, but one of the most beautiful little airfields in the UK, you know, on the top of this hill down in Dorset. And on episode 2, I think, he flies in the Heritage Hangar Spitfire from Biggin Hill. And you should see, again, the grin on his face as he's throwing this thing around down by the Isle of Wight, not the Isle of Wight, by the White Cliffs of Dover. But a absolutely brilliant program on general aviation where he just pootles around the country. The Scotland one, just amazing. Shows me, you know, just reminds you why you love flying up in Scotland. But a definite, you know, people talk about our little book club on Twitter. Well, three people do. But that is definitely a program.
All three of our listeners.
Yes, that is definitely a program that all you guys need to watch as well if you haven't seen it.
Right, we're on.
Cool,
that's it.
Just back to that book club idea, right, gents? I know you give me some great ones for World War II. Has anyone got any good ones about Vietnam, by any chance?
Chicken Hawk is a book I read when I was younger. I haven't read it for a while, but that was about helicopters in Vietnam.
I think I remember you saying something about this.
Yeah, you know, again, one thing that stays with me that is, you know, trying to bounce one of these Hueys into the air, which is massively overloaded, trying to get some forward speed on it. But I seem to remember that being a good one. Help me out, boys. What sort of fixed wing books?
There must be some, and it's not very fashionable, I don't think, but there must be some out there written from the Vietnamese point of view. Because I was looking up their kill ratios the other day. And considering what they were doing and who they're fighting against, they're mighty impressive.
Yeah, definitely. I'll tell you what, let's go and research that, and we'll on the next pod, we'll just come out with a couple of books. Parky, Dunk, can you think of any at the moment? Have you read?
I haven't read any about Vietnam, I have to say. I don't think I've read any about that.
Robin Olds is... biography is absolutely amazing. I mean, there's a hero fighter pilot, absolutely revered in the US. He fought in the Second World War, in the Korean War, and was the Wolfpack wing leader in from Thailand in the Vietnam War in F-4s. And, you know, people would have followed that guy to the ends of the earth. The most amazing moustache as well. you know, just a full legend. But and so his biography is worth a read and talks about Vietnam as well. But we'll get back to you on that, I guess. Right, should we do some questions?
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to suggest.
Now, here's a good one from our old pal Ian Savage, who said, if there was a choice, dogfight in World War One or World War Two, which I think is a really interesting question.
That is an interesting question. I mean, crikey. Do you know, the thing is, it comes back to survival aspects, I think, because, you know, if you know that you're going to have to go and fight, you'd, I think, prefer to fight and have more of a chance of surviving, even if you get shot down. And when you look at what those guys were doing in World War One, in terms of, you know, they had no protection at all on the aeroplanes, and they were literally within a number of yards of each other to shoot each other down. It's effectively, you know, running around with machine guns with no cover. You just have to, you know, maneuver that aeroplane. And the chances are that if you get shot down, you haven't got a parachute to jump out with anyway, because that was seen as cowardice.
Yeah,
they didn't have parachutes.
Were they even using pistols?
Down in flames with your aeroplane. So that sounds a bit miserable to me, doesn't it? You know, it's one of those things that I think, given the again the performance of the Second World War aircraft with the Spitz and the Hurricanes, etc., and the fact you at least had a parachute, I'm going to go World War Two.
Parker?
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, and I guess as well, you know, we're so lucky to have flown what we've flown, but I can't, it's exactly just the slowness and the vulnerability of those little World War One. I've never flown anything like that, but just having seen them, they're tiny, you know, and boy, did they used to get in close. I'm sure it was, as you say, you know, literally 30 foot or something they'd be in. It'd be just ridiculous. Yeah, World War Two.
Yeah, I'm going War Two as well. Just, I think all of us have got those emotional attachments to those aeroplanes, and frankly, I like a bit of cover from the elements. I like going to war with a bit of air conditioning.
Just out of interest, do the RAF still have anything like a Sopwith Camel knocking about? Is that in the collection?
Not airworthy.
Not in the Air Force. But the Shuttleworth collection has got all sorts of both World War One aircraft. It's even got pre-World War One aircraft. I mean, that is an amazing collection as well.
Yeah.
And if you can get along to one of their air shows, if you're lucky enough to have the weather and see everything flying from the box kite all the way through, they have the Lysander that Parky was talking
about
earlier.
Sorry, is that the black Lysander?
Yeah. Yeah.
I know the one you mean.
Yeah. So, I mean, they have just got the most phenomenal collection. I went along there. We were invited, so CFS was invited, and myself and Ben Monaghan, who was the commandant at the time, went along. And we were lucky to have one of these fantastic days. I got very fired up about all of those aeroplanes, and I knew some of the guys down there. And I said, well, you know, perhaps I could come down and be part of it. And they said no.
You're too experienced, mate.
So so that was that.
They don't want the skull crusher.
can you imagine that?
So here's a question from, this is Wilf at Wilf157. This is almost damning by faint praise. I still have to catch up on the earlier episodes, but can you answer which can pull more G, a fast jet or an aerobatic aircraft like the Edge 540?
Ooh, hang on. Before you go on to that, explain to me what an Edge 540 is, because I have no idea.
We thought you'd read the whole of Wikipedia.
Got to be a combat aircraft. I'm not really interested.
No, it's a little prop aeroplane, isn't it?
Yeah, it'd be like an extra, won't it? You know, yeah. A acrobatic-y.
I think they can pull more.
Yeah, I think it's just my understanding on that one would be they, you know, when you pull G, you bleed speed, you're creating so much drag, so they can instantaneously pull, God knows, 10 G or whatever.
Yeah, 10 or 11,
but,
I think.
Yeah, but they wouldn't be able to sustain it, whereas a Typhoon at low level will sit at 9 G until its fuel runs out.
Or you compress into a small OXO cube.
Yes. Or your back waves.
Yeah. Yeah, your back snaps when you stop straining. Yeah. So I've just looked up H540, and it is exactly what it sounds like, you know, sort of Red Bull, air racing type machine. And I just happened to be watching the Red Bull air racing on TV the other day because, do you see Ben Murphy got had a really good result just last week or the week before? And they do talk about it was. Paul Bonhamer had flown, it was an older one, but Paul Bonhamer flew a horse for the TV beforehand and was talking his way through it and mentioned, here's a 12G pull up as he pulled up around the corner. So instantaneously, exactly as you say, more than a fast jet, but there's nowhere near that they're sustaining that.
Wow.
Lightweight.
I'd love to see Mason's face with 12G.
I went in the when you go down to the centrifuge, they take a video, looking straight on. They give you this video at the end, which I've got. I'll see if I can do some sort of fettling to send you a copy of it. But I look angry.
I looked 193. I look like the Emperor out of The Empire Strikes Back. Here's one. This is from David Wookie, who we met at Farnborough. So clearly not you, Parky. Although there is one on here that says it's one question. It says, "Where's Parky? We miss him."
That was from me.
Ever flown an aircraft in the microlight category? Remember when we spoke? I mentioned training in a C-42. Now I have. Have you boys?
I've flown a what are they? It's not a microlight. It's a we got a wing, and you have to when you
hang glider. Together,
what are they called?
Hang gliding. JB just
hang glide. Yeah, but a powered one.
Yeah, that's exactly what I've flown in. That's a microlight.
Yeah, that's a microlight. It's like a tent frame with a.
But no stick or anything. It was kind of like I was hanging under this thing, and
see, I don't think that's a microlight.
I was sat in a little body, a little fiberglass shell underneath that wing. It was in a two-seat one with a prop on the back, and it was when
that's a microlight.
Yeah, but I was holding it down.
It's like a powered hang glider of some sort.
I think it sounds similar. It was definitely a pushy propeller thing, little tricycle under the carriage, and
same thing.
A great big bar that you sort of.
Did you enjoy it, Parky?
Yeah, I did. It was quite good fun. It was just some mate just went, let's do it. And then the weird one was when I was at Blackpool and some mate took me up in an auto gyro, just completely spontaneous.
Don't get me wrong.
That was ridiculously brilliant fun.
Have you seen JB? Have you seen the auto gyros?
I have actually. Yeah, they're kind of are they like semi helicopters? Is that what we're looking at? Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So the engine gives the forward speed. You give the blades a push, and it's then the forward speed of that aeroplane that keeps the blades spinning and provides the lift from the disc. You know, famously, what was the name of the guy who flew Little Nelly?
Ken Wallace, was it?
That was it. Yeah, because Tony Cooper flew with Ken Wallace. They were both on their 90th birthday, and they went flying in one of his autogyros.
Yes.
Hey, I'm just looking on Google now at microlights. They seem remarkably accessible. Remarkably accessible, actually.
They are, and nowadays, you can get a microlight that'll do, I might be plucking it out of thin air, but I think they'll do 180 knots, and on a ridiculously sleek looking machine, so it's fast, it's cheap. They are, and they're as you say, they're really accessible.
Yeah, so there's an awful lot of microlights that you just think are, you know, Cessna or Tutor type aeroplanes, but they're ultra lightweight, aren't they? And I think they're in the microlight class because of the weight category. Or maybe, you know, not being a general aviation expert there, but it does make it a lot more accessible because they're so much cheaper to fly.
Yeah, so they're going from 300 kilograms.
I started flying at a little place just north of Cranwell. So my friend Rod said, "Will you, do you want to come and fly my aeroplane?" So I started flying a little Piper Clipper from a little place called Temple Brewer, just north of Cranwell. And it's a lovely little place. And there's, you know, it's sort of, again, back to the good old days of flying. And there's just a bunch of generally sort of older fellas. And one of them's got a microlight like you've just described, Goddess. And he said he's got 5,000 hours, wasn't it? You know, he's...
Hang on, 5,000 hours? That's a yes. Huge amount of, I mean, for anything, 10,000 hours is maybe Bill Gates.
So, yeah, he's pretty good at this. But, you know, he's great, you know, just comes in, pulls his aeroplane out, goes flying around a bit. That's what he does.
So, gents, I've just looked up here. They are between 300 kilograms for a single-seat land plane to 472 kilograms for a two-seat. And that has a parachute system on it too. That's nice to know, isn't it?
Oh, that is good. That saved quite a few people.
Yeah, yeah. He weighs the same amount as you, Doug.
I was going to say it doubles its weight when he gets in it.
Tell you what,
this guy is the same thing. I was looking around this microlight of his, and yeah, it's got a parachute on the top. I thought he'd put some amusing sticker on there, you know, like an ejection seat sticker, keep well clear. But actually, I said, that actually is a might not be a rocket, but it's some sort of charge that blows the parachute out and he just floats gently to the ground.
Oof, don't want to be pulling that. Well, why don't we go microlighting next summer?
Oh, we're in. I'm in. Let's give it a go.
Looks like you just rock up to a field somewhere and they give you a machine.
Temple Brewer, we're going there.
Yeah, all right.
Hey, shall we have one final question then?
Yeah, go on then.
And this is a belter. I do like this. This is from a very good mate of ours, Christian Gleave. And this is a good question. I'm trying to think frantically on this one. What soundtrack would you most like to fly to?
Oh, God, that is such a Gleavey question, isn't it?
I can't think of anything. I'm institutionalized because I can only think of one vision from Queen because of what movie was that? Iron Eagle, Highway to the Danger Zone, or the Magic Roundabout.
Who is the one? I've got one. What was the one that you told me about, Dunk? You told me about someone who, did he compose a song and his mate wouldn't play it or something?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that was the, I think we've spoken about it before.
Yeah, we definitely have.
Play pilot. He was that, composed
was that
his
Chris?
Own. Yeah, it was. And he composed his own, and then Dan Stutch put on YMCA as he was hovering down the line.
Dunk, do you remember, Dunk, when we were on the Reds? I'm sure you're there. And we landed, I'm sure, at Shawbury. And Joe, you've seen kind of the Reds taxi. It's kind of like nine aircraft, and you just follow the leader, and you're all bunched up together. But essentially, Spike took a wrong turning. So we ended up going completely around. Following.
I thought you were going to say it's like the band on Animal House that all go up the one-way street.
But it's kind of like that. So we go around, and I don't know, I'm sure it was Dan Simmons. He quickly must have got his phone out, Googled this tune, and then transmitted it on the radio. So if you can imagine the Reds, and we're all just following, and we've got lost, and we're just going around. And he got the Benny Hill theme tune out. And it was utterly, you know, and it was just, we were crying with laughter.
What soundtrack would you have?
I think the Benny Hill theme tune for every Dunk trip.
The only thing that that I can think of is, was it the Good Morning Britain one on the Gulf War? And they had the Bon Jovi song on that. Was it Steel, it's on a steel horse or something. I'm a cowboy or something like that. I can't remember what the song's called.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I know.
Do you know the one I mean?
Yeah.
That's a belter.
You're always humming Eye of the Tiger when you go out to your plane, Dunk.
Well, it has to be something like that that gets you fired up.
Do you know the only thing that I would listen to whilst flying an aircraft?
Go on.
Pilot Episodes Pod.
Yeah.
Over and over, on repeat.
Yeah, that's totally.
Imagine
get
the amount
up,
of crashes there'd be as you glazed over.
Well, what if you were going flying, JB? What would you listen to? I guess you don't have time to listen to music because you're busy recording 5,000 podcasts.
Do you know
listening to 5,000?
It's one of the few things I'm just not into. Doesn't do anything for me. Don't own any CDs. Don't really have any playlists. Don't do anything. Nothing.
So if you
useful.
Were a professional rugby player, you wouldn't have your beats on listening to some music firing you up before you hit that ruck.
I'd have my beats on, but I'd probably be listening to myself.
You'd make a good vice pilot.
There you go. Well, hang on, just a follow-up question on that then. When you are flying, are you allowed to take like an iPad, or sorry, not an iPad, an iPod with you back in the day, or your phone, or something to listen to? There's no entertainment system, is there, in a Typhoon?
No.
You're not allowed.
Bizarrely, in the F3, you used to load your route data via one of those old cassette things.
You did say, yeah.
And there was...
A C90.
Yeah, there was an audio on it, because do you remember one mate had a burst of nose wheel because he was listening to Dire Straits or something? And it was bad. It was very naughty. But I do remember... One time after a Joya mission, it was sort of dawn, and we all had a break, and we put the wings back, and I think it was Bat Out of Hell we were playing on the train. Oh, we felt good.
So presumably...
As well as our book club, we've got a playlist now that we need to put on Spotify.
So presumably...
Oh, my God.
Presumably, right, when your friend burst his wheel landing the F3, right, did they listen
back... I don't think it was just a burst wheel.
All
I
right.
Well,
well, whatever he did they go back to the cockpit recorder and then listen to the music?
Yes. It didn't go well for him.
I can only imagine.
Didn't they eject?
Yes.
What? So just tell me.
I don't think he did that for a burst tire, Parky.
So he stuffed the nose wheel up through the airframe.
They were listening to Dire Straits and they burst a tire.
I was trying to make the story sound a little bit better.
So what happened then? they land this aircraft, and then what?
Yeah, it was a sort of... It was a pre-arm thrust reversey thing where... So with the Tornado, you had thrust reverse. So you would, you know, like jets airliners have, so you can power up to help you stop. But if you put the pre-arm thrust reverse and you're still flying, with the nose wheel still in the air... Clearly, the massive deceleration caused this thing to smack itself down onto the ground and essentially break the nose of the aircraft off.
Oh.
Which is not a way of landing.
And you never thought to turn off the tape player. Devastated.
It's all gone wrong.
Yeah. I mean, that was a major error there. Not the landing. It was a tape player.
Oh. I once I was. Because we, you do. We were going over and doing, trails across the Atlantic, and you'd end up a long time just sat on your own, and you think, right, well, what am I going to do? So I thought, right, well, I'll take some earbuds that I can put in my ear and at least maybe listen to some music. But the trouble is that it's just so noisy in that bloody aeroplane anyway that it was not. I tried to get them into my ear. Couldn't hear anything anyway and took them out after about 10 seconds. But the Tornado is so much quieter, isn't it? It's just a beautiful, beautifully quiet, smooth aeroplane to fly in.
Very quiet, yeah. Very, very quiet. That's its one claim to fame. Very quiet.
So if you're flying next to each other in two single-seat aircraft, do you just open up some sort of radio channel and dit away?
Yeah, I mean, you've got a radio frequency, so you can transmit to each other, yeah. But obviously the comms is always completely professional. There's no way you'd ever say...
There's no pub quizzes or anything.
I'm sure.
I can't believe it, JB.
I've got some reservations. Let's put it that way. Right. Have you got any more questions? Does anyone want to say anything else? I'll say something else. I hope we will do another podcast before this date, but we're going on the A380 simulator, right?
Yeah.
Looking forward to that.
Ages away. If we haven't done another podcast before then we're slipping a bit. Because it's been holiday season, but we've been a bit naughty.
We haven't been bad.
Done one for flipping ages.
Yeah, true.
So this is our first for a while. So I think we need to sort of get back into it a bit, don't we?
Yeah, exactly. So I know when I enter the A380 simulator, I'm going to be super excited. I know that way in advance. And a Godfrey.
Having seen you get into that Gulfstream, we're going to have to strap you down first and wheel you in like Hannibal Lecter on that.
Or maybe put
on that box trolley.
Big sponges to his arms and legs just so he doesn't smash the thing up.
Well, I also know Godfrey is going to be very, very excited to go because that's the kind of chap he is. Not sure about parking, but I just want to make sure, Duncan, you're not going to sit there and look as disappointed as you looked in the Gulfstream.
JP, you will see why he's called Skull Crusher.
Continually grumbling, this is rubbish.
Yeah, what is this? And
their
lead salesman.
Faster? Why can't we go upside down?
Exactly. And the salesman for all Northern Europe is saying, and it's based on F-35 technology. Oh, is it? Oh, really? Brilliant.
I just don't think we need to get in the sim at 6 in the morning or 4 in the morning or whatever.
Oh, God. JP, how about you and I just go?
Exactly. Rather than listen to all the misery.
We don't need a 6-hour sim slot. That's all I'm saying.
6 hours is a long time.
Can you imagine our three listeners, what they would give to have a go on an A380?
Listen to it. Oh, I can't get up at less than 9 o'clock.
The Mace is going to do a full transatlantic crossing or something.
I am going to
Yes,
fly
and then we're
going to
do
Albania,
the
NG. I told you.
So I've got a feeling it's going to be relatively easy to fly, right? Because I think all these things are relatively easy to fly. That said, I think we should do some audio where we can do almost like a film scene, and you're going to fly me. You're going to talk me down in the aircraft with no prior knowledge of ever handling one.
Well, JB, that is I love sweeping generalisations like that. That is just I think it'll be pretty easy to fly. Well, I think what we should do,
to be fair, it was you that told me this. Your description was, yeah, mate, you just press a button. That's literally what you said.
And I think you've got to program it first.
Oh, really?
Ooh. Well, I think so. I don't think you just press a button and it does it.
Yeah, it reads your mind, JB.
Wow. This sounds easier than I originally thought.
For you. My dad will enjoy this. Right, so in a similar vein, when the Harrier was shutting down, the Harrier sim, we got to be able to take our family to the Harrier sim. And so my dad, I said, do you want to come have a go in the Harrier sim? And of course he was like, oh, brilliant. So he's a bit like you, JB, in that he's a bit of a geek. So he's got flight simulators. He had a Harrier flight simulator. And so in the same sort of sweeping generalization way that you've just spoken about, we got him in the sim and I got him on the aircraft carrier. So he was on the aircraft carrier and I was explaining, you know, it's just saying, right, this is how you're going to do it. And he said, I know. I went, okay, off you go then. So I just I let him go. And as he crashed off the end of the carrier,
rolled upside down into the sea.
I reset him back on there and said, are you going to listen to me now? and he did then, to be
now,
fair.
Did but you?
I'm hoping to see a similar thing.
Did we speak about this? I have so many bloody conversations I can hardly remember. But were you telling me that you set the simulations so that there'd be some weird task, like you've got to drop bombs from a certain height and land before the bombs hit or something silly?
That's right. Christmas charity.
That's the one.
Yeah. I think they do it in most sims, don't they?
Yeah.
They certainly do it at Linton.
Yeah, they do it at Lossie. They do it at Coningsby as well.
Yeah.
Wow.
Intercept Harry Potter. ID Harry Potter on a broom.
You have to pay, you know, so for instance, I think it's a fiver a time here at Linton. So you pay however many times you can do it, you know, and then all that money goes in the pot. And if you win, you get the pot and half of it goes to charity.
or, you know, something like that. So,
I've intercepted an X-Wing fighter and the Millennium Falcon.
Oh, and how did you get on?
Oh, brilliant.
Nailed it.
I still don't quite understand the Falcon, the way that the guns work when they go out to a ladder, both climb up, even though they're going in opposite directions. But I couldn't see that from where I was sitting on his wing.
I guess our listeners can expect all those fun and games when we go to the A380 simulator, then. Unless Godfrey just wants to do a straightforward transatlantic flight.
Oh, no, I'm in. No, I'm taking us to Vegas.
Perfect. Perfect.
I presume when you step out, there's a simulated Vegas just outside the sim door.
Hey, yeah. Talking about simulation, next week, by the time we do the next podcast, I will have been to the United States of America. I'm going to go and look at a thing called Pilot Training Next, which is they've got a project where they are looking to see if they can train a pilot from scratch all the way through to F-16, just mostly on virtual reality and augmented reality. There is a bit of live flying in there as well, but it's vastly reduced from what most of the guys get. So we're going to go and have a look at that next week.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's going to be brilliant. So maybe I'll be able to have a chat about that on the next pod.
Yeah.
Is that the one, Dunk, you said you were going to Shepherd in Texas?
I'm going on there afterwards, yeah, but that's a different part of the visit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It does sort of remind me of when we went to Gulfstream again, back to Gulfstream. And for the price that you paid for the aircraft, they also give you two pilots. But they don't give you two pilots, do they? They train up two pilots. Was that right?
Oh, I don't know about that. I don't know.
Like, you've got to provide your own.
I was glazed over, like you said.
Yeah, you've got to provide your own pilots, but they'll train them up. And I thought, wouldn't it be funny if you just sent two absolute reprobates? two 17-year-olds just dragged off the street. Here you go, train them up.
Train these boys. I'm not sure. Again, I'm not sure that's how it works, JB.
That's what I'm assuming. Hey, look, if I've spent 70 million, I'll decide who's going to fly. Thank you very much.
And I want a 17-year-old with a tattoo across his face.
Yeah. Hey, you said that you'd train him. Get him trained. Excellent. Right, well,
on that bombshell.
Yeah, we've clearly run out of things to talk about. Yeah, we'll leave it there. So remember, follow us at Pilot Episodes Pod. If you've got any questions, that'd be great. We don't have an email or anything, do we?
No, nothing
like that.
Yes. I tell you what, we are. I'll tell you the other thing. We might have pilot episodes coming out on an alternative format. So stand by for that, because it might actually make the radio, weirdly enough.
Is it Braille?
12-inch LP, mate.
No. We could all take turns rubbing Parky's face. That'll be roughly the same.
The pilot that time forgot.
Yeah. So, join us on Twitter at Pilot Episode Pod. And hopefully we'll be with you before the A380 sim. But if we're not, we'll see you there. From me, Dunk, and Godders. Oh, and Parky. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Well done, gents.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.